Look, I've admitted to feeling all sorts of body discomfort, but perimenopause has taken it to the next level. I do not know what is coming next. And if anyone can relate, I recommend Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is a supplement for women experiencing hormonal imbalance or those symptoms of hormonal imbalance, including those going through perimenopause, menopause, even postmenopause. I'm not the only one using it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Happy Mammoth is the company that created Hormone Harmony. They use science-backed ingredients to help with those chaotic hormonal changes that happen to many of us throughout our lives. Night sweats, feeling down, or feeling tired all the time. Hormone Harmony can help with these symptoms. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's HappyMammoth.com. Use code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today. Once autumn hits, my wardrobe shifts from bright colors and trendy fashion to a more clean classic look, and quality fabrics matter more once pumpkin spice is on the menu. Luckily, I found Quince. Quince is unique in offering timeless, high-quality wardrobe pieces, but at a price I can afford, like cashmere shirts and washable silk tops priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they're not lowering fabric quality. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use ethical manufacturing practices. I recently just received their ultra stretch wide leg pants and an ivory Mongolian cashmere tee. The total was less than a single fall top I bought last year. Make switching seasons a breeze with Quince's high quality closet essentials. Go to quince.com/hiddentruecrime for free shipping on your order and 365 day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/hiddentruecrime to get free shipping and 365 day returns. Quince.com/hiddentruecrime. In response to the interview we did with Deborah and Chris Stearns, the parents of Stefan Stearns, this was an episode we recorded last week strictly to share on patreon.com/hiddentruecrime. That is the place where you can listen to over 60 bonus HTC episodes that we spontaneously record on our phone's voice memo app while sitting at our kitchen table. We publish these behind-the-scenes conversations for our Patreon subscribers. But we decided to publish this one right here in podcast form after comments on Patreon, comments from listeners listening to this episode. They told us it was important to share more widely despite the audio quality on my phone. So here it is. It's Dr. John and I discussing the controversial interview with the parents of Stefan Stearns, a man behind bars charged with over 60 sex crimes, as well as first-degree murder in the death of 13-year-old Madeline Soto. We answer your questions, delve into your criticism, and give our take on why this interview was so important. For more of these types of behind-the-scenes conversations with us that we record only for our Patreon listeners, you can head to patreon.com/hiddentruecrime to hear more. Hello, Patreon Hidden Gems. It's Lauren and John sitting at our table, and we are actually, sitting here having a conversation about the Stearns interview that we just did, the Madeline Soto. For those that don't know, we interviewed the parents of Stefan Stearns, which was certainly controversial, and we're sitting here talking about it, and I said, wait, let's flip on my phone recording for this behind the scenes conversation we're having and invite all of you in, because we are talking about some of the comments and we realized that we want to share a little bit about how we got this interview, what this interview is. Again, Stefan Stearns is the man who is behind bars for sexually abusing Madeline Soto, little Madeline Soto, for 13 years, or who was 13 years old when she was killed, and he is also behind bars for first-degree murder and killing her. So abusing her for years and killing her. And these are Stefan Stearns' parents, Debbie and Chris Stearns, that we interviewed. So we wanted to tell you a bit of the background, why we did it, discuss some of the controversy behind it, and we're talking to each other, so we're inviting you in. Right? Yep. Did I cover it all, John?
Yep. Thanks for joining us. So do you want to start with, how you were able to contact them?
Yeah. So let's start with how this interview happened. There had been a lot of questions about what in the world. So yeah, I was the one that got in touch with them. So I'll tell you about that. You know, as we always share, we genuinely, really, truly try to get an understanding of all the cases we cover. And we do try to reach out to several people behind the scenes. And these were two of the people we tried to reach out to. I looked and found her number. Actually, someone helped me find it. Deborah Stern's number. And I reached out with a text. This was probably a couple months ago. And I introduced myself. I said, I'm with Hidden True Crime, YouTube and podcast. We have covered, this was after our first episode. I said, we have covered your son's, you know, we have covered this. And if you would be ever willing to talk, let us know. And sometimes I send those texts into the abyss and I never hear back.
Most of the time. Well, one thing that we're fortunate to have at this point is a large community that's really helpful to us. And so oftentimes when we start covering a new crime, our community will know someone or have some contacts that might have some understanding or deep understanding or some closer contact with the case. And a lot of times people will reach out to us. So we're really fortunate that we do oftentimes have contact with some of the key players in a lot of the cases we cover.
Yeah. And of course, understanding the criminals behind the crime is a big part of Hidden True Crime, right? So a great example is Heather Daybell. Heather and Matt Daybell, when we started covering the Daybell case, they reached out to us. And of course, they're connected to the criminal, the murderer.
Yeah.
And they wanted to offer what they knew to help in our continued analysis. And they were genuinely very helpful. And that was for well over a year before Heather even decided to interview with us. So there's a lot of behind the scenes that goes on. And this is what John does for his work too. When you're assessing a criminal, you have to get collateral interviews. And correct me if I'm wrong or right, but you reach out to family and you try to get numerous people.
Right. It's part of the process of developing a deeper understanding of what's going on, understanding family dynamics. And like in my case, just corroborating information. So if I'm talking to a perpetrator and the perpetrator says, this happened in my childhood, or this was a trauma that occurred to me, I don't know necessarily if that's accurate. So I typically will reach out to third, you know, parties and collateral sources to get their version of the story.
Right.
And to corroborate that what they're telling me is accurate, or at least to get a different perspective from someone about a similar incident. So
right, and to listen to them. And
yeah.
You know? Right. And so that the Stearns are no exception to this in trying to understand how this could happen to little Madeline. It seemed like his parents are a good place to start to understand. And we did realize that they were talking to the police, and you know, we didn't know where they stood, but that's what I did, is I sent a text. And I think I sent that text in a morning, and it wasn't even 24 hours. It was that evening that I heard back from them, because they speak together on the text, and they said they didn't know about our channel, but they went to watch it and what we had done. We had only done one episode, and they essentially said that after listening to our episode, their attorney had told them not to talk to anyone, but if we promised an off-the-record conversation, they would talk to us. And of course, that conversation remains off the record. I can share that we've been in contact with them, clearly, but so that's what we did.
You talked to them the first time.
Yeah.
And then they reached out a few times after that. All of this is off the record. I was involved in one or two of the additional conversations
where we learned a lot.
Yeah, we learned a lot about the case. So, yeah, it's important to reiterate that I'd say most of our sources are anonymous and off the record, and so we obviously value people's privacy, and we keep things confidential, and that's a big part of what I do professionally and what Lauren does. And, you know, we know so many secrets on so many cases, but we can't divulge them. They do help us understand things at a different level, but, you know, we're very fortunate that people trust us and they reach out to us, and we learn a lot of things that we can't disclose publicly, but it does help us understand cases at a deeper level.
Right. For example, if the Stearns never decided to interview with us, we would never have ever shared that we were in contact with them.
Yeah.
So, but I will say this, because we talked about this in the interview, and so I have permission to share this. They certainly have been processing this with the public at the same time. Like, they have shifted, as evidence has come out, they have shifted their perception of everything. And I think that's fair to say, and I said that in the interview as much, so I can share that here. They have
changed. They've been trying to make sense of it. And and some of their views have changed.
Yes.
So we've had very different conversations with them over time. And why don't you talk about how they decided to
interview.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have these off-record conversations, things they have been developing and changing their views too on things and coming to different conclusions and changing their views, which, you know, I do respect that process. I can't imagine. And then every time, I'll just say this to give them credit too, every time we did an episode, we even thought at times that they'll never reach out to us again, because we have to be honest in our analysis, and our analysis was sometimes different than where they were in their processing of the case. And we never veered from just how guilty Stephen Stearns is, and
we believed he was
yeah. Right. And allegedly. Right. And, so I actually saw that I received a text message, and I actually got nervous, admittedly. I've never shared this with anyone. Like, when I saw that they had texted, because I thought, oh no, are they going to say, I can't believe you said this about whatever. But again, we just stick true to our assessment. And I opened it, and it simply said, we understand that our son is the sole perpetrator and responsible for what happened to Madeline Soto. We would like to be forthcoming and help in any way. And while we've been told not to talk, we feel like with all the evidence out there, it doesn't really matter. We want to be able to help, and would like to give you guys an exclusive interview if you are interested.
Right. And that was a Friday, I believe, Thursday or Friday. And then we didn't want to waste any time given that opportunity, so we conducted the interview Saturday, the next day.
Yes. Like
pretty quickly,
yeah. And a lot of people, by the way, were wondering if I was distracted or texting on my phone because we had to do this so fast. I wasn't. I was writing time codes on my phone because I knew that we had to put this interview out so quickly. It was important to be timely, in my opinion, with an interview that was this heavy, to like not wait a few days or a week to edit. Like, this needed to be done at this time. So what I was doing on my phone during the interview, if anyone watched it, was I was writing down time codes of things that I wanted to go back and look at before the editing. And then other people pointed out in comments that there were some jump cuts, though they could see that we had edited. I want you guys to know that there were breaks in the interview. And there were a couple places where they, you know, pointed out that, oh, maybe this. And I did, because of the way the interview flowed, it was so kind of all over the place. I just picked, I did switch a couple of things. Like, the entire interview took 2 hours and 1 minute. And you guys saw an hour and 57 minutes. So very little was edited, but there were just a couple things. And then I did switch the direction of a couple topics to make it flow better. So that's...
And there, we told them at the beginning that if there were any issues that they believed were too sensitive or controversial, that they could tell us to remove them.
Yeah, and there was one thing. So, yeah. And that's something we give every person we interview pre-recorded. We'll say, look, this isn't gotcha journalism. We want you to be comfortable doing this interview and not be on guard. So just be yourselves. And if there's something you regret telling us and you realize you do not want that in the interview, we give you that grace to tell us and we'll take it out. And there was one of those. So we did that for them. Yeah. So that's how the interview came about. And do you want to share the why we chose to do it? Like, some people are wondering if we should have even given them a platform because of what their son did.
Well, yeah. So I think the why is...
Or what we believe their son did.
The why is multi-layered in the sense that oftentimes we will communicate with the victim's families and we'll deal with kind of the grief on the victim side. But it's less common that we have a relationship with the perpetrator's side and the perpetrator's family. And because in many cases, the perpetrator's families are in denial. And they don't want to talk to people like us, and they don't want to show their grief. And like,
or their shame, too.
Or their shame, right? All of it. And I think the Stearns felt like they were being inundated with a lot of unfair accusations that were blaming them for a lot of what happened with their son. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I think for us, our job is to paint a picture of the entire situation. And part of that is the grief, potentially, the grief that parents of a perpetrator who believe their son will never see the light of day again, to give them a platform to share their experiences and their grieving. And, you know, one of the things I talk about with Lauren a lot is the idea that my job and our channel, I think a lot of times we deal with the unthinkable. And this, I think, was one of those scenarios. No matter what people think of the Stearns or how much they're being blamed or held accountable or whatever or vilified, these are grieving parents that have come to the recognition or the belief that their child will never get out, that he's guilty and he will never get out of prison, and it's going to forever change their relationship with them. So to me, that's grief. And, you know, one of the movies and books I sometimes talk about is there's a movie called and a book called We Need to Talk About Kevin, which looks at a mass murderer who's a teenager and how he's raised and the family's culpability and to maybe to a lesser degree, the mother's grief after he commits this mass murder and it's clear that he's going to be in prison the rest of his life. And so I think that's a valid perspective. You know, how does the perpetrator's family, how do his parents cope with this event? How do they make sense of it? You know, how do they make sense of the unthinkable? Right. And I think part of the job of our channel is to dive into that realm that few people are willing to dive into and to process what that means. And, you know, part of dealing with this question of the unthinkable is finding words. It's finding language to express something that's unexpressible. And I think that's what we're trying to do in this interview. Like, you'll notice, Lauren said one of the criticisms was of me, I guess, was that I was being too soft on them, that I wasn't asking hard enough questions. That's not my job in this situation.
Or can I tell you one of the most stressful parts for me, the other commenters? I held my breath when you did it. And it was hard for other commenters, and I completely respect what you did, but they gave us some things about him. We asked them for a bio. We asked them for a bio of Stephen Stearns, and they wrote all this stuff, the good, the bad, the ugly, the good memories, and they wrote about how he had empathy. And when you brought up, tell us about the empathy you saw, even I held my breath during that moment. I was grateful for your support during the interview because I'm usually interviewing victims, not... the perpetrator's family, and you do this every day. And I...
Yeah, let me talk about that. That's yeah. really important.
And a lot of commenters were like, what the heck? Like, how could you do that? That's so intense. Like,
no, yeah. no, it's, let me explain that. So they wrote, they sent us a bio that was quite lengthy. And, you know, obviously we're going to jump up. We got it with like 2 hours before the interview. So I had to go through it really quickly. It was really important. Like, one of the things I take a lot of pride in with my job is I'll go through every document I can, and I want to understand as much as I can about everything before I do an interview or an evaluation. And so I thought it was really important that they sent this and that I had to read it. And I noticed that they talked about his empathy. And I thought it was really important to bring that up because it's, again, if we're dealing with this issue of the unthinkable creates fear. It creates uncertainty. It creates anger, right? And a lot of times those qualities, that fear and that anger, gets projected onto not only the perpetrator, but the parents. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we had here. You know, there's a lot of projection of this fear and this anger and this uncertainty that people want to simplify things to the most elemental level so that they can feel like it makes sense to them, right? And the reason I brought up the empathy was because it really challenges that narrative. Like, if you have the narrative that Stefan Stern is a monster, and, you know, maybe his mother called him a monster in the interview later.
Yeah.
That if you have that narrative, then you're not gonna see him as someone with empathy. But, however, like, my perspective in the what I was trying to figure out in the – so Stefan Stern is a different creature in the sense that I see him as more of a sex offender. I see him as more of a pedophile, or let's say a possible pedophile, right? And it's important for people to understand that a pedophile is different than a psychopath. A psychopath can be a pedophile, but a psychopath or an antisocial personality disorder, they typically lack empathy. But a pedophile who's trying to develop a relationship with a child, they might have empathy.
Yeah.
And so what's important about that is to see, is to make a distinction between someone who might be like a stone cold killer and someone who might have empathy and is capable of developing a close relationship with a child and then abusing that child and then murdering that child for whatever reasons. We don't know why, right? But like, I want to challenge this narrative that every single perpetrator we deal with is the same. They're not.
Hidden True Crime is prepping to record live podcasts on the road while meeting many of you along the way. We want to connect to all of our gems without language being a barrier. Enter the most trusted language learning program, Rosetta Stone. It immerses you in a language you're learning, and it's available on desktop or app, perfect for on-the-road learning. We're excited to learn Spanish, French, Italian, Korean, and more. Excited to speak, listen, and think in a new language through an intuitive process. First with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Join with us. Do not put off learning that language. No better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, Hidden True Crime listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Artifact Uprising is a company that John and I have used to preserve our most special family memories for years. Artifact Uprising is driven by the same belief we hold, that everyone has a story to tell, and they tell these stories through premium quality albums and prints. We purchased their signature lay flat album 8 years ago for our wedding album, and when our son was born, we purchased the same album again to preserve his milestones. Artifact Uprising now wants to help our gems preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want a photo to hang and display or an album with impeccable quality and design to cherish for years to come, we've trusted Artifact Uprising with preserving our most cherished memories and telling our family story from the moment John and I met. And they encourage you to tell your story too. Through the end of the year, Hidden True Crime listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers, or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use code HiddenTrueCrime through December 31st. Healthcare often blames weight as a moral failing on the patient, but Mochi Health
listens. Their founder, Dr. Myra Ahmad, saw providers use shame when discussing patients' hypertension or dismiss medical concerns due to bias and refused to use safe and affordable medications. She changed this with Mochi Health, their mission to make patients feel heard and understood. They work alongside their patients without shame or blame and make obesity care affordable and accessible for everyone, regardless of insurance coverage. Mochi Health is a holistic approach to weight loss that includes board-certified doctors, dietitians, and medication delivered to your door, including GLP-1s like Ozempic. Get started with achievable results at joinmochi.com. That's joinmochi.com and use code HiddenTrueCrime for $40 off.
Some of them, like Stephen Stearns, might have empathy and they might use it in the capacity of forming a close relationship with a child to abuse that child. And ironically, like in Stephen Stearns' case, I really do feel at some level that he felt very close to Maddie. I mean, I'm not justifying it, right? Obviously, everything he did was immoral and disgusting and illegal, and right?
But he's where he should be right now.
But I'm trying to look at this from his perspective, right? Like, to him, he feels like he's in love with this little girl. He feels like he can walk in her shoes. In other words, he has empathy for her.
Mm. Yeah.
He's not necessarily thinking, I'm going to develop a relationship with this girl and then murder her as she gets older. I'm just trying to say, like, every narrative of a perpetrator is different. And I wanted to learn about, I brought that up because I wanted to see how his parents perceived that. Do they understand that he was using this empathy to develop emotional closeness with a child so that he could abuse that child, right? Like, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah.
This is not, I think a lot of people want to see this as a case of a psychopath with no emotions and no empathy killing a child. But it's more than that. Like, I brought it up to deal with the complexities of this case. I didn't bring it up because I'm overly sympathetic with them or I'm overly sympathetic with the perpetrator. There was a clear reason. If I'm in a clinical interview, if I'm in a forensic interview, these are the types of things I'm interested in. And for those who really paid attention to kind of my approach in this interview, almost all the questions I was asking were trying to delve into the origins of possibly the origins of pedophilia. So like, I wanted to know essentially, like my perception here is this is more about pedophilia than it is about psychopathy or being a psychopath. And so I wanted to know, and I wanted our listeners to see, what does a parent who's raising a potential pedophile, how do they see it? Were there elements in their childhood that led to their child becoming a pedophile?
Right.
Right? Like, what are the qualities that when they raised this child, what were some of the characteristics and the traits that they saw in their child that might later lead to this type of crime? That's what my questioning was addressing. And empathy is part of that, because pedophiles are quite capable of being empathic with their victims. In fact, that's part of the grooming process.
Right.
So I wasn't doing this to let anybody off the hook. I wasn't doing this to create sympathy in the situation. I wasn't doing right. I think I was doing this quite specifically to get their perspective on how they perceived him to be empathic and whether that might apply to the situation with Madeline Soto.
Well, and I think it was important because that question and them talking about empathy that they perceived in him actually did help kind of change my view too about the crime and about what, more specifically, Jennifer Soto. Jennifer Soto, I mean, there's quite the witch hunt online with Jennifer Soto, right? You know, and I certainly were all compelled by what Jennifer Soto knew or didn't know and how in the world she could be allowing her daughter to be sleeping with her on and off again boyfriend. Like, that's the thing that everyone keeps bringing up. And to hear about Stephen Stearns' quote unquote empathy makes me actually think, gosh, he was really capable of getting the trust of not just Madeline, but also Jen. And as the Stearns talk about how Madeline genuinely wanted to co-sleep. I believe that's true. There are many children out there who desire through fear, anxiety, comfort to co-sleep. You know, maybe Jennifer really didn't know.
Yeah.
Maybe she really was manipulated by Stefan Stern.
Well, he started the abuse at a young age.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I really do think at some level that Stefan Stearns believed that he loved Madeline and that she loved him. And, you know, for some pedophiles, they just don't, they know at some level that's wrong, but they don't really care, right? Like it's, you know, and this is where some narcissism comes in, that he's obviously just concerned about meeting his needs and feeling loved by this child. And he doesn't really, so that's where the antisocial part comes in. He doesn't really care about transgressing normal rules and laws to get what he wants from this little child. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have empathy. That's the irony, right? And so I don't necessarily think this is a case of a stone-cold psychopath murdering a child. I think it's more than that. It's more complex than that, especially with the possible pedophilia. So that's what I was after. And, you know, if you look at what the parents said when I read that and asked about it, they pointed to all these stories about him being close to animals, right? And think about that for a minute. So there's a lot of research out there showing that almost all serial killers are the opposite. Serial killers are probably the closest form of pure psychopaths we know of. And serial killers, almost every one of them, and again, there's research showing this, they harm animals, they kill animals, they have no connection to animals. But this guy does.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's interesting because it does, it was an interesting answer because it does show some degree of empathy. But if you want to understand Stefan Stearns, this is important because the empathy went a long way towards him developing a close relationship with the child. That's why it's important. I mean, I could not obviously articulate this on the interview. My job is to listen. So one of the things I've learned about walking into a room where we're going to talk about the unbearable and the unthinkable and stuff that people almost everywhere don't want to talk about is that you need to first and foremost listen. My job isn't to walk in there judgmental and formulate an opinion and say you're lying, although I do that sometimes depending on the circumstance. I've done that plenty of times. My job basically, if you want to understand the unthinkable, you need to listen. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to ask questions that would allow that. I wanted to give them the space to formulate difficult ideas or difficult feelings and thoughts in that interview that would allow them to begin to make sense of it. And part of that, I think, was not only kind of letting them process their grief, but asking questions about that I thought were interesting in terms of understanding their son and how he was able to arrive at a point where he did what he did.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you for sharing that. And I think I did understand it as it continued. That's why, you know, I kept my mouth shut and just breathed in and let you go. But yeah. And this is what you do for your work. Like, this is no different than what you do for your work. So we were seeing you do what you do. Is that right?
I mean, no. In my work, I'm going to be more focused on, I mean, to some degree, yes. In my work, I'm going to be dealing with the perpetrator directly. And I'm going to have certain hypotheses. I'm going to come into the room with certain hypotheses about, like, pedophilia and what I think were some of the elements that might have led to that. So I guess there's a similarity in the sense that I did have some ideas about what contributed to the pedophilia and murder. But yes, I mean, the challenge aspect of this interview would be less typically than it would be with the perpetrator. Like, I feel like grieving parents are a different thing than a perpetrator. And a perpetrator almost typically is going to be in more denial and they're going to be more defensive and they're going to be angrier, right? I mean, the parents have some of that because they're being blamed for a lot of stuff. But But I think it's a different type of interview in the sense that I don't, you know, like, I think they're still trying to make sense of this situation, and they're trying to make sense of...
They are.
They're trying to make sense of something that's essentially unthinkable and unbearable. And, like, I have a lot of empathy for that. Like, I know, you know, a lot of their answer to why was that he had a traumatic brain injury.
Correct.
Right? That's a lot of their explanation. And I'm sure people probably struggled with that.
Yeah, a lot of people criticize them for making excuses for their son.
But I think what's important to understand about that is this is a grieving, these are grieving parents that essentially, at least Deborah acknowledged, Deborah called her son a monster late in this interview. Like, these are grieving parents that are acknowledging that their son did this horrible thing and now they have to live with it and they will never see their son again.
Right. Right? And they have to die knowing what he did.
And so, I don't disagree with the fact that they're simplifying this and they're probably trying to formulate something that makes sense to them.
They're trying to figure out how in the world this could happen.
Right. They're doing it in a way that they're doing it in a way where their parenting has perhaps less influence on the outcome, right? Like they're trying to probably make themselves feel a little better. But I can't fault them at this point. I don't fault them at all for trying to make sense of it. Like, how do any of us deal with the unthinkable?
Right.
Are we gonna like fully embrace?
We're gonna sing Taylor Swift. Me, I'm the problem. It's me. Me, it's all me. No, you're gonna try to like look at the entire childhood and be like, what went wrong and when?
If there are issues from his childhood that they contributed to the situation, I think it's going to take them a lot of time to come to terms with that. So in terms of making sense of it now and seeing it as a function of TBI, that's part of this process.
It is.
And it's part of putting into words. Like, the one thing about the unthinkable is we can't express it often. When people experience a trauma, they lose the ability to express what they're feeling and what they're thinking. Like, it upends their entire sense of the world. It upends all their assumptions about the world. And part of trauma is trying to put the pieces back together in language, in words, with feelings that allows us to re-engage with the world. I guess we have two choices, right? We can just give up and we can despair and we can say, this was so horrible. I'm not going to go on anymore, right? I'm just going to be depressed the rest of my life and not move forward. Or we can try to talk to people or at least like reflect on it ourselves and put something into language and emotions, feelings, right? Express something that helps us make sense of it. And I think that's what they're doing. So whatever it is they're saying, you know, even if it's partially an excuse for certain things, let's say, hypothetically, I think that's what I would expect. And I don't fault them for that at all, because they're just trying to make sense. They're just trying to put the pieces of the world back together so that they can function and that they can not blame themselves every day for the rest of their lives and fall into this total depression and self-destruct, right? They're just trying to make sense of it so they can go on.
And I want to say I admire them for doing that publicly. Because what they were essentially processing it with us publicly, which is something we do not see often.
Yeah.
With the parents of the perpetrator. And I felt it was real and it was important to learn from. And it was important to see how perpetrators' parents grieve and process and try to just survive, right? Knowing that their son is a monster, quote unquote, Deborah at the end, you know, I am grateful for that, because if we want to understand the impacts of crime, what they allowed us to do, I want to say was remarkable in my opinion, that they gave the public this opportunity to see them deal with the unthinkable.
Right. And we don't,
and they're not perfect, you know?
We hear from a lot of victims' families and we see them processing their grief. And it's a similar process in a way, I think, like just trying to make sense of the unthinkable and express something that's often inexpressible. But yeah, I agree. Like, I think what's all lost in the shuffle oftentimes is that the perpetrators have parents. The perpetrators, right, they have mothers, fathers, whatever. And they too go through a process of grieving. They too, like, they too have to come to terms with the fact that they put this destructiveness out into the world, not necessarily directly. They didn't expect to have a child that would do this, obviously, but they have to make sense of it. And we don't see that as often. So yeah, I feel like that's why we did this, was just to let people, you know, since they were willing to share it.
Which I thank them for.
Yeah. Since they were willing to share it, I think it's, you know, to me at least, it's really valuable to see that other side and to see, you know, because so many of the crimes we deal with, the perpetrator side, they're in complete denial.
Right. Or, you know, the laundries. Just,
yeah, the laundries. Yeah. But so many families where the Daybell kids.
The Daybell kids, right.
You know, there's so many instances where the reality of being associated with a, quote, monster, unquote, is really unbearable, right? And
that most would never come forward publicly.
Right, exactly. And so, his parents come forward and to be so honest and open about it, I hope, shed some light not only on Stefan, but also the grieving process on the other side of the equation, the perpetrator's side of the equation.
Yeah. Yes. This is a question many people asked, and so it's something I think I can answer. When it comes to a lot of the interviews that Gray Hughes did with people that know the Stearns, and knew Stefan, and there are some very interesting interviews Gray Hughes did. There was one though, that was a third party. It was someone that said, somebody said something. Mm-hmm. And it was about Deborah Stearns allegedly paying somebody off to keep something that Stefan Stearns had done, like recording footage, like a secret. And just, you know, this is a third party interview. So right. It's not a direct interview. Mm-hmm. And from the very beginning, I just want you guys all to know that Deborah, we forgot to bring that up on our part. I was going to ask that. But so I want you to know that privately, Deborah Stearns has always said that is simply not true. And I can tell you that I believe her. I personally believe her. I'm talking for myself and only me, because from what else I have seen from Debbie Stearns privately and publicly, she has been very proactive in calling the police, even about possible other things she's now concerned that Stefan might have done. What I have seen leads me to believe her. But I realize different people might believe different things, but I was going to ask her, and she has said that's simply not true. And she has stated, if anybody ever told me of a crime my son committed or I knew of something, I would call the police. That's her answer to that, if anybody is wondering. It's a question we didn't ask.
And it's also worth noting that they handed over his computer, hard drives. Like, if they were hiding something, why would they do that?
Right. They have handed over a lot, and a lot of evidence that people don't know about too. They have given everything they can think of to,
right, which is inconsistent with someone trying to pay to cover something up, you know. So
right.
And also, you know, I mean, I don't know, it could be true, but I don't think so either. And we were going to talk about it, we didn't have the time, and we felt like the direction we were going in, it didn't really fit with the tenor of the interview. But but also, you know, third parties saying stuff like that in court is not considered evidence. It's considered hearsay.
Right.
That's not to say that there can't be some validity to it. Maybe there is, but, you know, you have to produce evidence.
Right. Right.
In a court of law, you can't have a third party come in and say stuff that there's no direct proof exists.
Right. And the interview was somebody said this to me.
Yeah.
So already you've got, let's have the person that this happened to come forward. And they haven't. And I also want to say this. Deborah Stearns wished that she had said to people, and this is something they thanked us for, that if stories like that come, they say that they believe good journalists should go to the source and ask or get the other side, or at least allow them the opportunity to share. And so I'm sharing that on behalf of the Stearns. They don't know we're doing this episode for Patreon, but I know it's something that she wanted known, and we didn't make that. We forgot that too, but that they valued that we went to the source with them. And of course, in journalism, there's oftentimes where people write an article to say, we did reach out to this other side. They did not comment, but at least they tried.
Right.
So I'm trying to think what else. Oh, another comment pointed out, you know, her lack of that maybe Debbie was still perhaps blaming Jen when I asked the question, do you believe Stefan manipulated Jen? And her response was a little bit like, what is Jen hiding? Feeling some, you know, separately, I want you to know that from Debbie, I've actually seen her give a lot of empathy to Jen, more than I think she showed on this interview. So I'm just sharing that. I'm not trying to make excuses or anything. I'm just sharing an honest thing. But I've seen both. But then them coming to the conclusion that he's the sole perpetrator sort of says...
Right.
But I think that they are still dealing with that. I think they are still dealing with what did Jen know. So I'm also not saying like that isn't the case either. I think that they probably, I don't know, maybe this is a question for you, John, that they maybe do feel a lot of anger or frustration.
We've seen in talking to them over the past 3 or 4 months, we've seen an evolution.
Yes.
And so I think it's important to note that while I'm sure they have some anger about that relationship and towards Jen, that to go from, I can't talk specifics here, but to go from
where they were
3 or 4 months ago to seeing their son as the sole perpetrator is a big change.
Yeah. And more specifically, I want to say the empathy that I've heard from Deborah about Jen that she is so heartbroken that Jen has lost her daughter.
Yeah.
And that her son did this to her daughter. Like, she feels... Like, I've had direct conversations with her about that. So, I don't know where she was in this interview, but just so you guys know, like, her heart goes out to Jen from what she's privately told me.
And I think blaming their son for everything is...
A start.
Is right. It's such a big step. And, you know, and people, I'm sure that on bad days, she's going to go back and forth, right? Like, people aren't.
I think we saw an honest back and forth in this interview. I think, you know, a lot of people didn't like that too. They're like, they say one thing and then say another. I'm like, I think that's being human.
That's people trying to figure out what's going on. That's people trying to make sense of the senseless, right? I mean, yeah, we all do that. You know, this is going to be something they're going to struggle with for the rest of their lives.
Right. Which they said as much. And I have a question for you, John. I want to know, to you, what was the most compelling part of the interview for you? For me, it was when I ended the recording. I thought it was like, for me, the most compelling part of any interview, I think the part that always gets to me is when it's just like the most raw and the most honest. And maybe even the most unthinkable, because, you know, the unfathomable.
Yeah.
At the very end of the interview, when she said, and I'll edit in the soundbite here, but when she said,
if he's executed, Chris has asked me if I wanted to be there. And I said, yes.
We were there when he was born, we'll be there when he dies.
I want him to know that there are two people in that room that are going to be sad when he's gone. And then we will send him with love.
Like, holy crap, like,
yeah, I think
to me that was like, unfortunately, it was at the very end. I don't even know how many people got to that. To me, that was like, how can you even fathom having that conversation with your spouse about your son being executed and processing if you want to be there.
Yeah, that was, to me, that was the most, one of the, probably the most emotional moment of the interview, because, you know, as a parent, just, again, getting back to this idea of the unthinkable, like, I don't think any parent, when they have a child, envisions sitting in a room behind a glass wall watching their child being executed, right? Like, I can't even...
No one thinks about that in parenting.
Nobody, right. That's not on the menu when you think about being a parent. Like, you think my child's going to, you know, have a good life. He's going to get married. He's going to do things in his life that make him happy, that bring him joy, whatever that is, right? That's...
And if someone's child does get in trouble with the law, you think he'll be out one day. He'll have a second chance. I'll hopefully get him parole. You're not thinking, should we be there when he's executed?
Right. And I think that also raises the question of whether love is unconditional. You know, they kept saying that, like, we're going to love our child no matter what.
So, and some commenters said, no, if my son did this, I'd stop loving him. I thought that was interesting. Some commenters were like, no, you leave him high and dry. Honestly, I think my love is unconditional for our son.
Mine is. You know, it would break my heart beyond
shattered
imagination. It would break my... I can't even imagine being in a room, you know, where my child is going to be executed and dealing with the grief and the heartbreak of my child. If it, you know, being in that position and my child harming other human beings, you know, but I mean, you know, but it's still my child, and you know, I don't know. I think that's another important part of this interview is, do you love the child? Should we love the child unconditionally, right? Like, even if they do the unthinkable, even if they do the worst imaginable, commit the worst imaginable crime that any human being can engage in, right? Do you still love that kid, right?
Unconditionally.
And
for me, I think, for me, the answer is yes. For me, I think I could never not love my child.
I don't know how I could do it any other way. I mean, I think I would tell my child, I can't believe you did this, right? Like,
I would even be disgusted at what my child did. I would be ashamed. I would die heartbroken. I would wonder if we should have ever had a child. Maybe even wish I never gave birth, but I couldn't stop loving him.
And I think it's important to, for when talking about this, to have empathy for the Stearns and for the families of perpetrators too, in the sense that that type of heartbreak has got to be unimaginable, right? Like, I, again, if I think about that being our son, I can't even fathom it. You know, I can't even go there emotionally.
And they never said he shouldn't be executed. Yeah. They never said, we're going to fight that he's not executed. They just said, we will love him and be there. We will miss him.
They're anticipating that he probably will be executed and he probably will get the death penalty. Of course, it'll take years for that to come to fruition.
Yeah. I think the other thing too is people have been disgusted that they've sent him money in prison and tried to make things nicer for him, and I think that goes along with the same idea of unconditional love.
Like, what are they supposed to do? Punish him? You know, I mean, he's being punished.
Yeah, rightfully so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think those are just the things we wanted to talk about. I'm trying to think if there's any other questions people had. Well, I guess, yeah, I have one last question for you. Well, I think people want to know, what are your thoughts on the TBI? That's the question. People want to know what you think. Like, is that, can TBIs have that?
TBI, a traumatic brain injury, can definitely affect personality. It can affect memory. it can affect so much. It depends on the extent, you know, the extent of the brain damage. Depends on the area of the brain. Do I think that the TBI is the sole cause of this? No, I don't. I think with almost all criminals that there are multiple causes, so multiple causation, and TBI, I think, could be one of those elements. I think there's more. I think there's no question that there's usually a combination of nature and nurture that affects these types of crimes. So pedophilia, for example, can involve some structural issues in the brain, like to the frontal lobes and to the amygdala. But that doesn't cause pedophilia. There typically are going to be other factors that play a role in terms of like sexual development, in terms of sexual interest, upbringing, right? Like there's always, I think, going to be more causal elements. There's going to be a series of causal elements. But, you know, in this particular case, I understand why they see the TBI as being the most important element.
Yeah.
Do I think that's the explanation? I think it's a partial explanation. I think it plays a role. I don't think it's the...
It's a puzzle.
Final explanation, right? I think that there's more here. If I was doing the forensic evaluation of Stefan, I would dig a lot deeper into a lot of issues, including issues in the family that they probably didn't talk about. So no, I mean... Does it play a role? Yes. Does it play the role? I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah. It's a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. It's one piece.
Thank you. Thanks for this episode. This was healthy for me to even debrief it. Just a couple announcements. I want to share a few things. Some people have noticed we haven't been going fully live like this, like what we just did here for our Patreon members recently. We've been doing a lot of pre-recorded, or the interview with the Stearns, or... you know, I just put out an Adelson video. That's something I recommend everyone checking out, because John and I do have plans in the future to do an analysis on the Adelsons, and I'm trying to do more backstories as well. Thank you for your feedback and saying that you like these backstories. We're going to try to do more of them because we want this analysis, and we want to have the understanding and background of the case. So we just did that with Adelsons. Many of you have been requesting that we assess them, or have John assess this crime and this family. That will happen. It won't happen tomorrow or you know, Saturday, because he needs a lot more time. But we are on our way. And we do have some live scheduled. Tomorrow, I believe, we're going to share an interview that I did. But we wanted to do this for our Patreon, because I know people have been missing that. But we are going to go back to our conversations like this too. But if... we have this lapse because we're doing more deep dives, we will be here on Patreon as well.
Yeah, Lauren and I, but in terms of my research, I'm spending a lot of time delving into some cases that just have so many documents and there's so much research to do that I need to take a little more time. Delphi would be one of those, the Adelsons. Yeah. There's a handful. We're also looking at, we're probably going to, since there's kind of been a Menendez brothers revival recently, I think we're going to be talking about the Menendez brothers, and I need to get updated on what's going on with them. So we're going to come back live. We're going to be coming back live in force. We're just dealing with some cases that are unusually difficult and have a huge amount of discovery and documents, and the research is a little more involved and takes a little more time. So I read an article about a podcast called Acquired, which I guess is about, I haven't listened to it personally, but it's about startups, technology startups, and the guy does like this incredible deep dive in these companies and how they were founded and all that kind of stuff. And I guess he does an episode like every 4 to 6 weeks because they're so involved. And I kind of
Understand that.
I kind of understood it. I'm like, you know, to go week after week after week with lives, you know, it requires so much preparation. And yeah, I've been kind of burned out. And sometimes I just need a little bit more time to really get my thoughts together and to dive deep into certain cases. And I could totally relate to the acquired guy and his need to take enough time to like really, really present a detailed analysis. So I feel like we're kind of like that. I mean, we're putting out content every week, but we'll be back. I promise that our analyses will be deep and special, and we're looking forward to coming back soon.
Yes. Live. And that is a great example. John was a little burned out, and we certainly needed more time for Delphi, and he certainly needs more time for Adelson's. So in the meantime, again, I'm pulling the stories together. The good news is there's two of us, so I'm taking the journalism route while you are deep diving into these very important cases. And right now, I hope to be at some, if not all, of the Delphi trial. And then also in Salt Lake City, I will be a guest with Annie Elise in Salt Lake City at Annie Elise with 10 to Life or the Serialistly podcast on October 17th. And for anyone that is interested in tickets, go to Annie Elise's website. It's her show. I'm honored to have been asked by her to be a guest with her for this live podcast. And I hope to meet some of you there. And I think that's the latest. Yeah. And so, and a fascinating interview again with someone coming. I think we're going to do that tomorrow.
Oh, and I'm working on, I'm producing a Patreon only episode that will be a little different. It's going to be very philosophical, I think. It's going to raise a lot of questions about the criminal mind, and I'm looking forward to that. I've been working on that for a couple weeks now, and we're going to be recording that soon. So it'll be different. I'll be looking forward to getting, you know, our Patreon members' feedback on it, but I'm excited about it, and that should be out soon.
We might even turn on our microphones for that one, right? Because it's a prepared podcast rather than these on a whim that we're doing with our phones. We'll pull out the microphones.
Yeah, that one will be much more professionally produced than just on the iPhone like this one. But anyway,
it'll be for our patrons.
This is a little afternoon snack. It's like noon-ish in Vegas, 1 o'clock. I don't know. So anyway, thanks for joining us. That's what we're up to. As always, let us know if you have any thoughts or questions or comments on this little snack. And we will obviously be in touch.
Great ending.
It's not the right ending.
It's not the right ending, but it works. Yes. We'll be in touch. Give us a call later. Yes. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day. We'll see ya.